I'd like to begin a new series this evening then entitled The Gospel in Prepositions. Now, I don't really want to begin with a grammar lesson, but just to remind you that a preposition is a word that defines the relationship between two other words in a sentence. So if somebody phones my house this evening, Hannah will answer the phone and she'll respond to the person on the other end, and her response then, it will include the word Dan, and it will include the word church. But she won't simply say Dan church and put the phone down, because that wouldn't make sense. She needs a word that defines the relationship between those two words, and so she will say something like Dan is at church, or Dan is in church, and there you have then a preposition. Or you might be at the doctor's, and the doctor gives you some pills which are only to be swallowed on a full stomach. And so the doctor will give you an instruction as you leave, and his instruction will include the word take the pills, and the word meal. But he won't simply say take meal, that wouldn't make sense. He needs to define the relationship between the two words, and so he will say take after a meal. And again, then, you have after a preposition. So I'm not going to say any more than that, because as I say, we're not really here tonight for a grammar lesson, but I hope you more or less get what I'm driving at. I remember when my mother taught me about prepositions, and she taught me the rule that you should never end a sentence with a preposition, and I took this rule very, very seriously. And a couple of days later, I was scandalized when my primary school teacher committed that very offense as she was writing something on the blackboard, and I don't think she was very amused or even really understood what I was talking about when I put my hand up and said, Miss, you've ended a sentence with a preposition. But there we are. So we're going to be looking then at the gospel in prepositions. We're going to be looking at seven prepositions which are integral, which relate very closely to the gospel. It might seem a rather odd, a rather random, perhaps even a gimmicky basis for a series, but I suppose my concern is always that if we're just working through books of the Bible, as we do so often in our preaching here, if we're just doing that, there's always the danger that we can lose the wood for the trees. Always the danger that we're constantly kind of touching on this aspect or that aspect of the gospel, but never really capturing the overall shape of the gospel. And I think at times then we need to stand back and recapture the overall shape of the gospel. And this, I thought, was one way of doing that. And so tonight then in our first session, our title is Death Through Sin. So there's your preposition, the word through. Death through sin. And I've taken the phrase from the passage that we read earlier on. It's a biblical phrase, it's in Romans chapter 5, verse 12. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. And all I want to do then is take this little phrase and look at each word, each of the three words in this phrase. I'm going to do so in reverse order. And so we'll look at the word sin, and then the word through, and then the word death. So first of all then, the word sin. Now sin, I suppose, isn't a word that you hear used all that much in our society these days, and when it is used, it tends to be in a fairly light-hearted manner. But you can't read the Bible without appreciating that sin is a hugely important concept within the Christian worldview, within the Christian gospel. And I think if we follow three kind of logical steps, we can perhaps bring out what this idea of sin is all about. So step number one then. If God has made us, then he has the right to regulate our behavior. If God has made us, then he has the right to regulate our behavior. Now, we're all familiar, aren't we, with the self-evident principle that if you have made something, then you can do with that thing whatever you please. If you've made it, you can do what you want with it. So if you make then a beautiful bird table and you go and erect it in your front garden, then you can do with that bird table subsequently whatever you please, can't you? So you can go out one day with a sledgehammer and you can smash it to pieces and no one can accuse you of vandalism. Or you can go out one day and yank it out of the ground and run down the street with it, and no one can accuse you of theft. You can go out one day with a spray can and write in big letters over the top of it, "I was here." And no one can demand that you be given an ASBO or made to do community service. You can, even if you want, go out and put a sign up alongside the bird table saying, "All birds welcome here except greenfinches." And no one could take you to court for illegal discrimination. It's your bird table. You've made it. You can do with it exactly as you please. And similarly then, if God has made us, then he can do with us exactly what he pleases. And if he decides then that he is going to relate to us not only as our maker, not only as our sustainer, but also as our legislator, if he decides that he is going to demand a certain kind of conduct from this human race which he has designed and he has built and which is his sole possession, if he decides he is going to regulate our behavior, then he has total freedom to do that. He's not being presumptuous. He's not being high-handed. He's not being intrusive. He is simply operating within his rights as creator. So that's step number one. Step number two, God has indeed regulated our behavior. God has indeed regulated our behavior. So it's not simply that he theoretically has the right to do so. He actually has done so. He has legislated. He has set the parameters of human conduct. He has issued definite commands and prohibitions. Do not have other gods beside me. Do not bow down to any graven images. Do not blaspheme my name. Keep the Sabbath day holy. Honor your father and mother. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not covet. Now, those are pretty unambiguous, aren't they? You don't read those and think, well, what's God trying to say here? Is he giving me a parable here? Is he giving me an allegory here? Is he giving me a proverb here? Is this a piece of apocalyptic literature? No, it's unmistakable. He's giving us a law. He is giving us legislation. He is exercising his prerogative as our maker. And he is governing the way that we behave. He is regulating the way that we behave. So that's step number two. Step number three. To violate God's regulations is to defy him. To violate God's regulations is to defy him. You see, you might be sitting there and thinking, well, I rather like some of those regulations that you mentioned just then a moment ago. I rather like the prohibition of murder and the prohibition of adultery, the prohibition of theft, the prohibition of lying, the prohibition of covetousness. Because murder and adultery and theft and lying and covetousness are profoundly antisocial acts. They are wronging other people. Society would function so much the better if it wasn't for those particular kinds of behavior. I rather like those regulations that you have just mentioned. And of course, it's true, isn't it, that those are antisocial courses of behavior. It's true that those things are wronging other people. It's true that society would function so much better without those particular things. And that is why God has given those regulations. Because God, of course, is wholly against antisocial behavior and wronging other people. But There's a further dimension to this, which perhaps you're not quite grasping. And it's this, that murder and adultery and theft and lying and covetousness aren't simply, they aren't solely antisocial acts. They aren't solely wronging other people. Precisely because God has given those regulations, precisely because God has given them, then necessarily they are also acts of defiance against Him. They are challenging His right to legislate us. When those things are done, the person who does them is effectively saying, I'm not listening to what God is saying. I'm not listening to His dictates and His demands. I am disregarding them. I am autonomous. I am replacing God with me. I am the one, not God, who is going to regulate the way in which I behave. So yes, those things, they are wrong in other people. But precisely because they have come from God, those regulations, they are inevitably, they are necessarily also acts of defiance against Him. And for this reason then, idolatry too, and blasphemy, and Sabbath breaking, and dishonoring one's parents, are no less serious than murder and adultery, and theft and lying and covetousness. Because you see, wronging other people is not the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is the fact that when any of those laws are broken, when any of those regulations are broken, God is defied. And that then really is taking us to the heart of what sin is. I suppose it's best demonstrated, best expressed, isn't it, in the Bible when you go to Psalm 51. And in Psalm 51, you have a man called David, and he has broken both the sixth and the seventh commandments. He has committed adultery. He's also basically committed murder. And yet in verse 4 of Psalm 51, he's addressing God, and he says there, against you, and you only have I sinned and done evil in your sight. Yes, of course, he had wronged Bathsheba. And yes, of course, he had wronged Uriah. But that all paled into insignificance alongside this, that he had defied God, because it is God who has said, you mustn't commit adultery. And it is God who has said, you mustn't murder. And this then is the true horror of sin, that sin is a direct strike against God. Sin is shaking one's fist against God, whether it's the kind of sin that also wrongs other people, and that's serious, of course it is, or whether it's the kind of sin that actually doesn't involve any other people at all. Sin, the breaking of God's regulations, sin is against God. It is turning one's face in the direction of the Almighty and saying, I'm disregarding you. I'm ignoring you. I'm challenging you. I'm taking you on. I'm doing what you have said I mustn't do. So that's the first word then, sin. Secondly though, the word through. The word through, and this preposition through then is teaching us that there is a connection between this concept of sin that we've just been talking about and death. There's a connection between sin and death. And I just want to ask two questions then. First question, why is there a connection? Why is there a connection between sin and death? And the answer is because God has decided that death is the appropriate penalty for sin. Now, once again, He has the right to do that. Let's go back to the principle I mentioned earlier. If he has made us, he has the right to do with us exactly as he pleases, just as you do with your bird table. And God then has, if God has allocated that death should be the penalty that is attached to sin, then he has the absolute right to do that. And he has done, and he has done it ever since the beginning. He did it in the Garden of Eden, didn't he? Remember, he said there to the first couple, to Adam and Eve, that you may eat of the fruit of any of the trees in this garden, except the fruit of the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And if you do eat the fruit of that tree, if you disobey me in this way, then you will die. Death was the penalty attached to sin. And it's expressed in many other places. Perhaps most famously, or one of the most famous instances, is in the next chapter of this epistle to the Romans, the last verse, verse 23. For the wages of sin is death. And it's a striking image then. It's developing an image Paul has used earlier in the chapter, the image of sin as a master. It's the idea then of sin coming along to human beings and saying to human beings, right, I want you to do something for me. I want you to go and bow down to that God over there, that idol over there. Or I want you to go and rebel against your parents. Or I want you to go and tell a lie. And if you do that, if you do this thing I'm asking you to do, then I'll pay you. I'll give you some wages. I'll give you a reward. I'll give you what I owe you for having done that for me. And so we human beings, we go away and we do it. We do what sin, this master sin has told us to do, and we go back to sin for our wages, and sin pays us, and it's death. It's a coffin. It's death that sin pays us as the wages for having done what he has asked us to do. So that's the first question. Why is there a connection? There's a connection between sin and death because God has said, God has decided, God has determined that death is the appropriate penalty. Second question, what is the connection between sin and my death? Because you see, you might be sitting there thinking, well, I'm under no illusions here. I'm going to die. I can see that. I'm going to die one day. I know I'm not going to live forever. I'm going to die. And yet, I'm not a sinner. I live a very decent life. I live a very respectable life. I live a very upstanding kind of life. I don't live a seedy kind of life. I don't live an immoral kind of life. I don't live a questionable or dubious kind of life at all. And yet I am going to die. So that doesn't fit with what you've just been saying. My death doesn't seem to have anything to do with sin. My death seems to be unconnected. So how then do you explain that? Well, two answers to that question. First answer, you sinned before you were even born. Now that may seem a terribly bizarre thing to say. How do you work that out then? You may be saying. Well, I'm not the first person to say it. Paul says it in this very verse, doesn't he? In Romans chapter 5, verse 12. He says there, sin entered the world through one man and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. Past tense. He's talking about a specific occasion. He's saying something quite remarkable. He's saying that there was a specific occasion when all the world's population from all the ages of history, every single human being that ever lives, when all committed a sin. Well, you say, how can that be? You couldn't even get all the population of the world from all the ages together to commit a sin. How on earth do the logistics of that work out? Well, you see, Paul is presupposing here something that the Bible teaches us, namely this, that the first man who ever lived, God's first created man, Adam, he had a different role to the rest of us. He had a representative role. He was a representative person. He represented others. So when he did things, he didn't just do things as a random one-off individual. He did things representing everyone else who would come after him. All his descendants, if you like. The entire human race. And so when he sinned, when he disobeyed God's rule, when he ate that fruit which God had said you mustn't eat, when he sinned, then it wasn't just him sinning, it was everyone else sinning as well, because he was representing everyone else. That this was the way God ordered things, the way God arranged things when he made Adam. He made him a representative figure. And so when Adam sinned, we all sinned as well. Now you might say, well, that's not fair. Well, let me say two things to that. I apologize, I keep proliferating two things here. But first thing to say to that is this, that the same principle I've said several times already. If God has made us, he has the right to do with us what he will. If he ordered things in this way, if he arranged things in such a way that the first man was a representative of everyone else, then we're not in a position to say, oh, you shouldn't have done that, that's not fair. Because he made us, we're his creatures. He has the right to do with us what he will, just as you do with your bird table. But then the second thing I'd say to that accusation of unfairness is this. Suppose when the people of London had gone along to the polling stations this past week to vote for a new mayor, suppose that alongside the candidates submitted by the Conservative Party and the candidates submitted by the Labour Party and the candidates submitted by the Liberal Democrats and so on, there had been a candidate submitted by God. God had put forward a candidate for London, for the mayor race. Then you would vote for that candidate, wouldn't you? You might not trust the Conservative Party to put forward a brilliant candidate. You might not trust the Lib Dems to do it. You might not trust Labour to do it. You might not trust any political party to do it. But you would trust God to put forward the best possible candidate as mayor to represent you as a citizen of London. And similarly then, when we look at Adam, we're looking at God's representative figure. God put Adam there. This was God's candidate to represent the rest of the human race. In other words, he was the best possible candidate. You wouldn't have done any better. Boris Johnson wouldn't have done any better. No one would have done any better. God put the best possible candidate. This was God's choice. And the best possible candidate messed up. And so, for those two reasons then, I think the accusation of unfairness doesn't really hold water. So that's the first thing. We're answering the question, what's the connection between death, between sin and my death? Well, the first thing is you sinned before you were ever born. You sinned through your representative, Adam. But secondly, you still sin. You yourself sin, quite apart from Adam and his sin. You sin. You sin daily. You sin all the time. And when you say that you're upstanding and decent and respectable and all the rest of it, you are doing so on the basis of too superficial a view of God's requirements. Because think about it. When God says that you mustn't have any other gods apart from him, have you really kept that requirement fully? Is it true that you have devoted 100% of your energy every single second of your life since the moment you were born to the service and to the glorification of the one true and living God? We think of the commandment to honor your parents. Is it true that you have never ever done or said or thought anything that was really derogatory toward your parents? Or the commandment not to commit adultery, thinking of Jesus' words about not even casting a furtive, lustful glance at a member of the opposite sex. Have you really always kept that? Has it not been just the most fleeting transgression of that particular law? As I say, if we think we're doing okay, it's because our views of God's law are too superficial. Every day, every hour of every day, we do sin. We do add to the guilt of our sin in Adam. We exacerbate that guilt. We add sin to sin to sin. And that's the connection then between sin and my death. Yes, I am going to die, and I am going to die because I am a sinner. So we've looked at the word sin, we've looked at the word through. But thirdly and finally, the word death. And I just want to say two things about that. First of all, it's more than just physical demise. Death in the Bible is more than just physical demise. Of course, there are times when the Bible tells us in a straightforward way, so-and-so died, and in that case, it's talking about death in a physical sense. But in many contexts, when the Bible is speaking, particularly in its more theological passages like this one, then death is more than just physical demise. We were thinking in our time out meeting this past week of that verse in John 11. John 11, verse 26, I think it is, where Jesus is conversing with Martha. This is on the occasion when he's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. And remember how he says to Martha that great, momentous claim, "I am the resurrection and the life." And he says to Martha, "Whoever lives and believes in me will never die." Now, in saying that, Jesus is clearly drawing a distinction, isn't he, between physical death and some other kind of death. Because, of course, believers in Jesus do die physically. Martha would die. Lazarus already had died and would die again one day. Believers in Jesus do die. But Jesus is saying that at another level they don't. So clearly there's another kind of death other than just the physical death. And we're talking then about that everlasting separation from God. And by separation, it doesn't just mean that, we don't mean that kind of God just leaves you to have a perfectly happy time without him. We mean torment and soul misery, soul suffering from God for all eternity. Hell, I suppose, is another word that we might often use for it. That's death, really, in its fullest biblical sense. But physical death is the normal entry point to that. And so the Bible can use that word death as shorthand for all the hell, all the torment, all the anguish which comes with it. If you go to Wooler, you see the signpost, I think, on the way in saying "Gateway to the Cheviots." If you go, I was brought up in the Vale of York, and if you went to somewhere like Beedale or Massam, you'd see signs saying "Gateway to the Dales." If you go to Oban or somewhere, it's "Gateway to the Islands." Stirling, it's "Gateway to the Highlands," and so on. Well, there's a sense in which death, in the biblical sense, is the gateway to hell. Death is the gateway to God's everlasting punishment for sin. And so that's what we're talking about here. We're not just talking about the shutting down of our bodies, our hearts ceasing to beat, and so on. We're talking here about something much more than that. And then the other thing to say about death is that it has an advocate. Death has an advocate, or if you like, it has an enforcer. There's that terrible phrase, isn't there? Well, it's a wonderful verse, but there's a terrible phrase within it. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14. Where it's talking about the work of Christ, but it talks about him in relation to someone else, someone who holds, the writer says, the power of death. There's someone who holds the power of death. Who's he talking about? He's talking about Satan, the devil, the evil one. He holds the power of death. What does that mean? Well, it perhaps means lots of things, but the least I think it means this. It means that Satan, who of course is elsewhere described in Revelation 12:10 as the accuser, Satan, has this kind of hellish ministry of going to God and saying to God, this person here, he must die. He has sinned. He sinned in Adam. He has sinned many times since. He must die. This woman here, she has sinned in Adam and many times since. She must die. This man, this woman, this boy, this girl. Satan enforces it. If ever God should forget, one single human being forget to impose death upon that person for their sins, Satan will remind him, all right. He has a ministry of death. He has a ministry of making sure those whose deaths, of course, he has indirectly brought about through his work in the Garden of Eden, do indeed die. And so, death through sin. Now you might be saying, well, isn't this series about the gospel? And prepositions. Doesn't the gospel mean good news? And it's not exactly good news what we've been thinking about tonight. It's almost undeviatingly miserable news, bad news, terrible news. But you see, it's the backdrop, isn't it, to the gospel. You can't understand the gospel unless you understand what the gospel is for. Unless you understand the backdrop against which the gospel shines as such a beautiful and wonderful and compelling light. And this is the backdrop, that all of us have sinned. All of us are counted by God as sinners. And there is this connection between sin and death, which God has made, and it's an infallible connection, and we must therefore, we will therefore all die. And there's one who will make sure that's the case, Satan, the one who holds the power of death. That's our plight as men and women. You might think that you've got many problems at work. You might think you've got many problems in the home. You might think you've got many problems in whatever different spheres you move in. And I don't want to play down those problems for 1 minute, but this is a problem that infinitely eclipses all other problems. This problem that we have sinned and we will die as punishment for our sins, a death that is not merely annihilation, just ceasing to be, but a death that is eternal torment, eternal agony, from the omnipotent God. That is our plight. It's a terrible, terrible plight. And that is the backdrop to the gospel. But I can't close there, because it may be that there's someone here and you'll never enter a church again, or you'll never hear the gospel itself articulated. And so I don't want to preempt all that I'm going to say in the coming weeks, but I just want to close by drawing your attention to that verse that I quoted in Hebrews. Hebrews 2:14, because it's not ultimately about Satan. The verse is about Christ. He came to destroy him who holds the power of death. And basically all that we're going to be looking at in the coming weeks is Christ. It's Christ. He's the answer to this plight. Christ is the answer that you need to this terrible plight, which embraces you. You need Christ. He's the one who destroys, the one who holds the power of death. He alone can solve this terrible, terrible, immeasurable problem. And that's why many of us in this room this evening believe in Christ. Not because we simply value his friendship and companionship in life. Not simply because we find him an inspiring, ethical example to us, not simply because when we're lonely, he's a great comfort and we can pray to him and all the rest of it. It's because he's a savior. It's because he's a rescuer. It's because he's a deliverer. It's because he is the only answer to this fact that we are sinners and are going to die eternal death. He's the only answer. That's why we believe in him. And I hope that even tonight, let alone before we get on to the other talks in this series, you too will believe savingly in Jesus Christ. Amen.